Now, D.B. Cooper, won't you please come back? I'm looking for you high and low. Cause leaving ain't polite in the middle of the night. D.B. Cooper, where did you go?
Good evening and welcome to Cooper 5-0. It's the 50th anniversary D.B. Cooper skyjacking special from Cairo Radio in Seattle. I'm Felix Bunnell. Over the next hour, we're going to explore the history of the hijacking that took place 50 years ago this very night. Northwest Airlines Flight 305 from Portland to Seattle. This is a fact-based show, not a lot of conspiracy theories. We've got some guests on tape, others joining me live in the studio or by phone. We're going to meet a photographer from the Seattle Times who was at the airport 50 years ago tonight, taking pictures of the passengers. We'll meet the kid, now a grown man, who found some of Cooper's cash along the Columbia River 41 years ago. And we'll hear from a passenger on the plane. We have a lot to get to. First, we're going to start with my exclusive interview with FBI Special Agent Larry Carr. The FBI closed the case 5 years ago. Agent Carr was in charge of the last sustained effort to solve the mystery. I had him start off by telling me the basics about what happened 50 years ago tonight.
On November 24th, 1971, a man entered the Portland airport. He bought a one-way ticket, I believe it was $20, to Seattle. It's a 30-minute flight. Later that afternoon, he boarded the flight, took his seat in row 18, I believe it was seat E, ordered a bourbon and 7-Up, smoked some Raleigh filter-tip cigarettes, and just as the plane was starting to roll down the runway for takeoff, he turned around and there was a stewardess sitting in the jump seat by the rear exit door, and he handed the stewardess a note that said, you know, he was hijacking the flight. And interestingly enough, her name was Florence Schaffner. She thought it was just him passing his phone number, hoping that, you know, she would call call him for a date or something like that. So she just put it in her pocket. She didn't even bother reading it. And when Dan Cooper saw her do that, he said, "Miss, I think you should read that note." And then she said something in reply, "Are you serious?" And he said, "Yes, come sit by me." And at that point in time, he made his demands. He wanted $200,000 in cash, four parachutes, two fronts, two back chutes, and he wanted to go to Mexico. And so Florence told the other flight attendants she was working with, Tina Mucklow, you know, "This gentleman is hijacking the flight. You need to sit by him. I'm going to the cockpit to relay the demands." When she got to the cockpit, she informed the crew. They informed Northwest, and Northwest informed the authorities that the flight was being hijacked. That information then filtered down to the FBI, and we went about getting all of the supplies he asked for. The $200,000 came from C-First Bank, which I believe is Bank of America today. And then the parachutes, the two front chutes came from Issaquah Sky Sports. And the two back chutes, one was an MB-6 Navy bailout rig. The other one was a Pioneer sports chute. We gathered the money, the chutes, and got it all to the airport. The flight had to circle for a couple hours while we got that all together. The plane landed. He was given the parachutes. He was given the money. He let everyone go except for the cockpit crew and Tina Mucklow. And then the plane departed to the south. And somewhere over Battleground, Washington, he jumped out, and he's never been heard from since.
And so the FBI is a lead agency and then is tasked with finding out what happened, finding out where Cooper landed and searching, looking for him.
Yeah, you know, the investigation started that night when the plane landed in Reno, collecting the evidence, of course, searching the plane for Cooper, interviewing all the passengers were taken by a bus to SeaTac, the terminal. They were all interviewed by FBI agents. And, of course, the crew was interviewed that night, as well as several other times throughout the investigation.
And now, the issue, the fact the money has never turned up, other than that $6,000 or so that I found along the Columbia back in 1980, that seems to be like a good indicator that Cooper never survived or never made it out of wherever he landed. Is that kind of the biggest clue in the whole thing about the fact he probably didn't survive?
Well, yes, it is. So the thing, one of the things Cooper, or one of the problems Cooper had, is when he got the money. Number one, he didn't request denominations, right? So he got a bunch of 20s, you know, $10,000 $20 bills. It weighed almost 20 pounds. And he got it in a C-First vault sack. And so you couldn't secure it in any way. It was just a big open vault sack with, you know, 20 pounds of $20 bills in it. So what he did is he cannibalized one of the front chutes, the reserves, and cut a bunch of parachute cords out. And then he tied the top of it. He cinched the top of it together and then wound the parachute cord around the top of the sack, tied that off. Then he took more cord and wound it top to bottom all the way around. So he kind of made a bundle. And then Tina Mucklow said the last thing she saw as she went to the cockpit when he was after the takeoff is he tied that bag that he made or the package that he made out of the vault sack to his belt. So I am sure that once Cooper jumped out of the plane at around 200 miles an hour, that thing just blew right off of him.
I suppose there's one scenario possible where the money gets away from him and he does land and survive. Is that
right? That's a possibility. You know, I always speculate that the money blew off of him. The plane was, you know, a little further to the east of flight path Victor 23. And then at one point, a flood through the Washougal watershed got the bag caught on a snag, and it floated down the Columbia, out the Washougal into the Columbia, and made its way up onto the beach. You know, the bag was eroding. Some bundles fell out. The rest of the bag floated out into the Columbia. You know, and one of the problems Cooper had is, and again, this is one of the clues that leads me to believe that he was one of these individuals that had just enough experience or just enough knowledge to be a danger to himself. So he had a choice. You know, so if Cooper was an expert and kind of really knew what he was doing, what he was getting himself into, he would have chosen the best and requested the best, you know, equipment to do the job that he was facing. But he didn't make any demands for the type of equipment. So he just got what they had. And interestingly enough, one of the actual reserve that he took with him was a classroom demo reserve. It was only half a parachute. So students, when they were taking lessons, if the main failed to deploy the secondary chute, they would go through the procedures, throw the chute out, and then roll it back up and put it back in the bag, the container. That's the one he took. It was mistakenly given to him from Issaquah Sky Sports. Mm-hmm. So for his main chute, he chose an NB-6 bailout rig. So it's a Navy backpack 6. It's used for pilots ejecting from an airplane. It has no steerability. It has a high rate of descent, and it has an instant opening. So there's no sleeve inside on the parachute to delay the opening. So there was a lot of shock that would have gone through that, especially at 200 miles an hour. But he also had his choice of a sport chute of the day that was steerable, had a sleeve to soften the opening, and it had a much slower rate of descent. But he chose the worst parachute for the job he was facing. You know, he was jumping out into an absolute unknown drop zone. He had no idea where he was at, except that he was somewhere south of Seattle. Huh. I mean, in fact, the pilots originally were discussing going out over the ocean because they didn't want to fly at 10,000 feet on Victor 23 because of the mountains. But they chose to go ahead and take Victor 23. Luckily for Cooper, or he would have jumped out over the ocean.
In terms of all this stuff that, just from your, you know, very close work on this case and your proximity and access to all those files and everything, do you have sort of the master theory about who D.B. Cooper was? I mean, not specifically who, but kind of his profile, why he did it, what he was trying to do, and what happened?
I've thought about this, and, you know, of course, you know, who was he, since we don't know, so we have to speculate by what we do know. So I believe, you know, he was a blue-collar guy, that he must have been a loner. He probably got fired from his job maybe his house was taken by the bank, something, because he said he had a grudge to Tina Mucklow. He just didn't say, he said, it wasn't with your airline. I've got no problem with your airline, but I do have a grudge, because she asked him, you know, why are you doing this? So I think he wanted money to fund his life, felt that he was entitled to it, and he was going to get it, you know, through this crime. I think, given the fact that he came up with the idea to jump out of an airplane, and he knew from the air where McCord Base was, how far it was to Seattle, I think that perhaps he was what was called a cargo kicker, you know, from military planes. So he was in the military, some branch, Air Force, Army. He worked as a cargo kicker, so he knew about parachutes, but he didn't actually use them. He wore them, knew how to put them on. He knew to fly the plane, to slow it down with the flaps and the wheels down, which, you know, you might do if you're throwing cargo out, so the parachutes don't rip at a high speed. And when he died, nobody, you know, missed him.
Why do you think we still care so much about this, and why the details are still interesting to so many people?
Well, I mean, come on. It's a great story. Yeah. You know, it even starts off with, it was a dark and stormy night. So it's just made for a lot of fun. You know, I think everybody loves a good mystery.
Yeah.
They're the number one sellers, and this is a great one.
That was FBI Special Agent Larry Carr, and this is Cooper 5-0, the D.B. Cooper 50th Anniversary Special. Now, next up, I recently pestered passenger Larry Feingold for minute details about his flight from Portland with D.B. Cooper.
Felix, that's 50 years ago. I can barely remember whether I was old enough to walk. But let's see. I'm sure, and of course, remember, in those days, all you did was you walked into an airport, went up to a ticket counter and purchased a ticket and went to the airplane without any security or anything else. My recollection is I probably had a reservation and just picked up a ticket at the airport, because that was before computers were spitting out tickets.
Yeah, I went to the Portland airport, you know, this summer and walked the distance from where the, you know, where you would have gotten out of your car and to the ticket counter and to the plane. And it was so short. I always think about SeaTac and that long, you know, the subway ride or the long walk out to the end of the B concourse. But this was like, in what I could figure was where the gate was, it was like maybe a couple hundred yards from the sidewalk to the gate.
If I recall, you just entered the airport and walked down a passageway, and there were, we actually climbed up some stairs to get to the airplane. They were not using any of the lamps.
You know, Ralph Himmelsbach's book, he says that there was construction, and they actually had you guys, you know, in the terminal, you walked downstairs onto the tarmac and then up the actual rear air stairs that he was eventually used for the hijacking or for the parachute jump.
Yeah. Well, I got to know Ralph rather well because I was in the U.S. Attorney's office. And over the years, we talked many, many times as this case was unfolding.
Yeah.
But I think he's right. I just remember the few people who were on the plane just all sat fairly close to each other because it was Thanksgiving Eve, and there were not many people on the plane, and it was a lousy weather evening. I think you've covered some of Seattle's famous storms, and that was a really stormy couple hours we were in the air. And then the other thing that stands out in my mind, it was a real storm that we flew into when we finally landed.
I read that the plane took off around a little bit after 3, and you didn't land until about 5:45 or something like that. So you're in the air for an extra probably 2 hours than you would for a normal Portland to Seattle flight.
Yeah. Yes, we were. And the pilot kept talking about what he announced. He came on every once in a while and announced that there were difficulties and they were in touch with the ground and working on it. And trying to make everybody comfortable, of course, coming on to the speakers and saying, we're trying to, you know, there's an issue and we're trying to resolve it. Didn't exactly in a stormy night give you great comfort. But as I said, he had a very smooth voice and certainly didn't sound as if there was, you know, a skyjacker on an airplane. But no one would have thought of a skyjacker in those days.
Yeah.
You know, now people, that may be the first thing they would assume. But certainly not them.
obviously, this is like a part of Northwest mythology now, and the story's been told many times, and you've been interviewed many, many times. Is there one particular memory that really stands out vividly from that evening 50 years ago?
I don't think any of the passengers knew that skyjacking was going on. The cabin attendant, Tina Mucklow, was very calm and cool as I look back on it. And the thing that stands out to me, since I didn't know what was going on, actually two things. One, when the plane landed, and we landed safely because, if I recall, they told us to get into a tucked position. If the plane crashes, it's going to do you much good to be in a tucked position, so maybe you're closer to the ground, so you break your head a little more easily. But what I remember is we were out on a far runway. This was before the third runway at SeaTac. And a fuel truck pulled up to the plane and started fueling the plane or taking fuel off. I didn't know which one. And I thought they care more about the fuel than they do about the passengers on this airplane because, again, we did not know there was a skyjacking. And I didn't learn that there was a skyjacking until finally they opened up the front entry of the plane. And an FBI agent who I had known and had worked with me, and I with him, I said, "John, what's going on?" And he said, "Larry, there's a skyjacker on the plane. Just, you know, we're dealing with the situation."
Huh.
So I think those things stand out. Assuming I'm still correct about it 50 years later, those things are something that are seared into my memory.
Passenger Larry Feingold, who rode along with D.B. Cooper 50 years ago on this very night, spoke with him recently from where he lives in Israel. I'm Felix Bonnell. This is Cooper 5-0, the D.B. Cooper 50th Anniversary Special on Cairo Radio. We'll have more after the news. Welcome back to Cooper 5-0 on Cairo Radio. We're marking 50 years since the D.B. Cooper unsolved hijacking. I'm Felix Bonnell. Joining me live in the studio is Seattle Times legendary photographer Greg Gilbert, good friend of mine. He's been with the newspaper for more than 50 years. And those don't include any years as a paper carrier, I'm pretty sure. It's all as a photographer, right?
All as a photographer.
And he was at SeaTac Airport in the terminal as the hijacking was unfolding 50 years ago at this very moment. He even photographed the passengers as they gathered in the old Northwest Airlines VIP lounge on the B concourse. I wonder if anyone listening tonight has ever been in the old VIP lounge of Northwest Airlines on the B concourse. Greg, thanks for taking time on Thanksgiving Eve to join us. What do you remember most vividly from 50 years ago this very night?
Well, it was like someone earlier said, it was a dark and stormy night. We were first dispatched to the Northwest Gate where the passengers were coming off. And we tried to commandeer a couple of passengers. I think there were 36 total. And most didn't want to talk. There was one guy that sort of stood out, and he answered questions. But the rest didn't. Most said, "I don't even know." Didn't even see the person because he was way in the back of the plane.
And was it like a media zoo, or was it just sort of somber? And what was the tone or the feel?
It was kind of a media zoo, but there weren't. I think I was the only still photographer. Though later, within an hour or so, there was a friend of mine, a photographer from the Portland Oregonian, and a reporter. They had driven up from Portland, I guess. It was kind of surprising to see them there. And then after we photographed, or I got a chance to see and photograph and interview the passengers, we were taken up to the roof, to a rooftop spot, to look out into the darkness and see the airplane that was still parked away. It was parked intentionally away from any ramps, but you could see it. It was probably maybe 1,000 feet or 1,500 feet away from the building.
And so did you. So you could actually see the plane out there from where you were standing. Did you actually see it leave and take off and everything?
I did. We watched it take off, and that was something that I don't think I've ever heard much talked about. But as the plane took off, immediately behind the plane was a large military helicopter lumbering up and away, which of course wouldn't be able to make 200 knots. So I don't know what they were thinking of in case, listen, maybe you saw the chute drop down in front of them or something.
Now, I've joked with you before, but anytime I do any historical research about anything that's happened in Seattle in the last 53 years, especially if it's the Seattle Times microfilm or online, I'll look and there's a picture of something. Nine times out of 10, it's Greg Gilbert, photographer. I mean, you took the photograph of the last person leaving Seattle, turn out the lights. You took that photograph of that billboard and countless other photos.
I did.
So it's, I mean, I can't thank you and your other colleagues enough for the work, kind of work I do now with history. I rely so much on the photographs and the information. I know now there was one other Seattle Times photographer out at the airport that night, and I actually tracked him down and talked to him. This is Bruce McKim.
I had a friend who was a police officer for the port, and he happened to be on that day, and he has since passed away. But he said, we don't know what it is, but the airplanes parked over by the east or the west side of the runway. And I can't tell you any more than that, but you can, in those days, there was a section to the south of the observation deck, which was usually locked out for dignitaries. And so he let a couple of us, TV photographer and myself, and I can't remember who the TV photographer was.
So that was some special, that wasn't the regular public observation deck. That was some different part of the roof of the old terminal building.
That is correct.
Was it actually a place that had handrails, like it was a VIP thing, or was it like just the roof?
No, it was just like, it was just an extension of the observation deck. And he said the whole area over there is locked off, and nope, we can't get you out there, but you stay here as long as you want to. And I got there around, oh, I think 5:30 or 6 in that neighborhood, and set up my 4x5 on a tripod and just hung out. And It was dark, and so shot a few frames, and then just stood by. And the picture that was used was while they were waiting for the ransom and the parachutes to come back.
And I'm pretty sure that's the only photograph of the actual hijacking in progress, because you can see the car there off to the left, and the shades are pulled on the windows for the 727. One thing, you know, I know the that party down at the Cooper Caper party down at the Ariel store down kind of west, east of I-5 around Woodland, that didn't start, I think, till the fifth anniversary in 1976. And I know I didn't really start paying attention to this. I think I was 11 years old when the money was found along the Columbia. That's when I was most excited about D.B. Cooper. I'm sure you probably didn't know on the very night 50 years ago that this was going to be some long-term thing. Did you assume that this was going to be solved, that there was, I mean, it was kind of a regular night for you being out at the airport taking pictures of something, right?
Sure. I think we all thought, well, the guy will find him and it'll not be a big deal. I was going to add, you know, Bruce McKim, he sounds pretty good for 85. And he had the forethought to bring a tripod and a long lens to get that really great shot that I didn't have, because I was on the roof with just regular camera lenses.
Yeah, I mean, the picture he took, the really famous photo, it's the, I don't know if it's some sort of extreme telephoto, but it makes the building behind it look like it's right next to the jet. And I was working with the SeaTac people earlier this summer, and we figured out that the building in the photo is the Prince of Peace Lutheran Church, which now it's blocked out completely by trees.
Wow.
Because that area has changed so much in 50 years, obviously.
Yeah, telephoto lens will do that.
Yeah. So how late were you at the airport? I mean, was there a reporter with you interviewing passengers, or how did that work?
Yeah, a reporter and I were out there. I don't remember who it was, but after we watched the plane take off, we scampered back. At that time, we were a morning paper, so we had an evening deadline. So I needed to get back to the paper and process my film and make prints.
Huh. And then in the ensuing search and everything and all the other kind of different kind of stops along the way with the money or different people who've come forward and claimed to be D.B. Cooper, did you get involved taking photographs of those kinds of things over the years?
Yeah, we had a tip-off. There was several paratrooper experts who said, hey, there's a guy out in the North End. We think he's the guy. And he didn't smoke, and B, he was shorter. But reporter Don Hanula and I went out to the guy's house. He was very open about it. He didn't restrict us or not want to be photographed. And we stopped along the way in a 7-Eleven and found a pair of sunglasses that sort of matched the style that Cooper had. We had him wear the sunglasses, and then we twinned up this guy's photo with the artist's sketch. It was a dead ringer. It was pretty amazing. But he had an alibi. He was having Thanksgiving dinner with his parents. But, you know, for $200,000, would your parents maybe lie for you? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's the pictures that I've looked at the Times microfilm from that day, and there are pictures of Larry Feingold, who we heard from earlier in the show. You shot his photograph. And I don't think he was quite the spokesman for the flight at that point, but he sort of emerged as the spokesperson over the years. So
yeah.
It's crazy that 50 years later, we're able to track you down and talk to you about something that happened and you were actually there witnessed it because it's one of these mythological events where there's so much speculation. You're one of the few people who actually was there and witnessed part of it. That's pretty cool.
Thank you.
So, all right.
Happy Thanksgiving, buddy.
Yeah, you too. And that's Greg Gilbert, longtime Seattle Times photographer. And you're still working for the Seattle Times, right?
This year is 54. Next year, July 10th of 2022 will be 55 years.
All right on. Congratulations. Well, we'll have you on for the 75th anniversary special in 25 years.
Now, bring a walker.
Coming up next, we meet a D.B. Cooper history hunter and the kid who found some of Cooper's money back in 1980. I'll tell you right now, spoiler alert, he's not a kid anymore. They'll join us live on Cooper 5-0, the D.B. Cooper 50th anniversary special on Cairo Radio with Felix Bonnell. Welcome back to Cooper 5-0 on Cairo Radio, marking 50 years since the D.B. Cooper hijacking. I'm Felix Bonnell, and I'm really excited for the guests who are joining us for the final segment of tonight's big show. I want to welcome Eric Euless. He's been searching this year along the Columbia River for D.B. Cooper's briefcase and parachute near where some of Cooper's money was found back in 1980. How are you doing tonight, Eric?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing, Felix?
Wonderful. Thanks for making time on Thanksgiving Eve. I also want to welcome...
Sure.
Brian Ingram, who was 8 years old when he found probably the biggest clue ever in the D.B. Cooper mystery, thousands of dollars in the sand near Vancouver, Washington, on the Columbia River. How are you doing tonight, Brian?
Doing great. How about yourself?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here. How did you actually find the money?
As a child, playing on the Columbia River, just trying to dig up some sand, trying to make a campfire, basically. Smoothing out the sand.
And did you know what it was right away?
No, it was dark in color. It looked like driftwood. It wasn't until we was able to shake off some of the sand we actually saw that it had printing on it, and that's when we could tell that it was bundles of 20s.
And I imagine as an 8-year-old, you'd probably never heard of D.B. Cooper before.
No, I hadn't. No, sure hadn't.
So what happened next in terms of, I know because it was a day or two later, the media coverage exploded. I think I was 11 years old at the time, I was 11, and it was a huge deal. It was media frenzy there for a few days. What happened between you finding it, and how did you guys kind of put two and two together?
Well, my dad went back to work and told some of his fellow workers that what he had found, and they had sparked the interest. They told him about the Cooper case, and so they called the police department and read off some of the cell numbers, and that was when we found out that what this was linked to, and that's really when we found out the impact of the find.
That's pretty cool, because I swear, without you having found that, we'd be talking about a very different story. I mean, because it was, the case obviously had grown very cold even by 1980, and this certainly fired things up again and created all this speculation. Now, Eric, you've been working with Brian for a long time. You're a D.B. Cooper expert. You've been studying the case. You've actually been out there along the Columbia digging this past autumn, in the last month or two, haven't you?
That's right. As a matter of fact, I was there last week digging basically looking for the missing parachutes in the briefcase, which ostensibly carried the bomb. I believe that D.B. Cooper buried not only the money on the beach there, but those other items as well, and that during the FBI search, they just simply missed the other items because they were looking in an area that was just slightly off from where they should have been looking.
Now, can you break any news tonight about what you may have found this past couple of weeks or past couple of months?
Unfortunately, no. And, you know, the thing about it is, even though it's only about 300 square feet of beach that we're looking at, the problem is that there's an enormous amount of like 3 or 4 feet of rock and dirt that's been placed on in the last 10, 15 years to actually stop erosion. So it's almost like digging through concrete to get through that layer to get down to the beach. So that's very labor intensive, takes a lot of time, and it's going to take some more time before we can actually find something there.
Can you explain how the fact the money was found where it was found, upriver from where the Lewis River enters the Columbia, can you explain how that changed the theories and changed the thinking on where Cooper may have landed?
Well, I mean, that was, when Brian found the money there, that got everybody scratching their heads in law enforcement because they, of course, expected or believed that D.B. Cooper had, landed some 20 miles away and moreover downriver. So really, it just kind of threw everything they knew on the table and just couldn't figure it out, basically. So they started thinking that perhaps he landed in the Washougal watershed area, further upstream and that type of thing. But in later years, through continued research, primarily in the private sector, we've determined that that was not accurate. And I believe, indeed, that this is an indication that the FBI's landing zone or jump zone was also not accurate.
Hmm. And, Brian, finding that money 41 years ago now, how did that change your life?
Just being part of the story is, and the case has been great. I meet a lot of people. I've met a lot of people over the years. Eric, one of them. List goes on. As a child, when I was young, I was thrown into the spotlight. It was kind of cool. I enjoyed it. There was a lot of negativity that come with it along the way. Anybody that knows the story and has read, they've seen that. But as my aspect of it, as an 8-year-old forward, it's been I've really enjoyed it.
Now, I know that you had to split the money, I think, with the insurance company.
Global Indemnities, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you still have any of the actual $20 bills left, or have you sold them, or what have you done with them?
I do have quite a few, quite a bit of the collection left, yes.
And how frequently do you take them out and look at them or show them off to people?
Not a lot. I've got a few put up that I can, put out that I can see whenever I want to look at them, but most of them are under lock and key.
Got it. It's a really cool piece of history. And again, without you as an 8-year-old playing along the banks of the Columbia 41 years ago, we'd have far less to talk about in terms of the D.B. Cooper mystery. All right. Eric, ask you the last question. Are you going to do any more digging or searching, or what's next for you with your research and your hunting that you're doing?
Sure. Yeah, the digging on Tina Bar continues. I believe that will be picked up again in January. And I suspect it's going to take a little bit of time. We'll be done with it in 2022. There's no doubt about that because, again, it's not a large area. But it's just very labor intensive. We cannot use equipment. It's all manual labor. And obviously I live in Arizona, so it's a little bit of a trek. It's not like I can just kind of park shop there for 3 weeks, but January is when I'll be there next. And I'm very confident that sometime over the next 12 months that we'll actually find something.
We'll do another special then, I promise. Well, listen, Eric Ulis, D.B. Cooper expert and D.B. Cooper hunter, and Brian Ingram, the once upon a time 8-year-old who found the D.B. Cooper money. Thank you so much for joining us for Cooper 5-0 this year.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
All right. Have a good Thanksgiving, you guys. Thanks again.
Same to you. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
All right. I want to thank everybody who helped me with this show. Cooper 5-0 here on Cairo Radio. Our program director, Brian Buckaloo. Our news director, Charlie Harger, who helped me get that wonderful interview with Larry Carr from the FBI. Greg Gilbert for stopping in as a guest, and Larry Feingold for speaking with me. Also want to thank board operator Shane Peterson. Hey, have a great Thanksgiving, everybody. Thanks for listening to Cairo Radio, and just have a wonderful 50th anniversary of the D.B. Cooper Golden Jubilee and our D.B. Cooper Cooper 5-0 anniversary program. Good night.
Lyle and D.B.
Where are you?
wish I was there. Hey, drop me a line if the sun's okay, would you?